From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the drug war in Mexico, the legacy of civil war still hunting Spain, and unifying the call to prayer in Cairo. In the 4 years since Mexican President Felipe Calderón launched his campaign against the drug cartels, at least 28,000 people have died in fighting between the cartels and the security forces and from the dealers' own internal rivalries. It's been a time of massacres, kidnapping, torture, and car bombings. And this year is on track to become the bloodiest yet. NPR's Jason Beaubien looks at the social impact on Mexicans of a war that has no end in sight.
The town of Taxco is a major tourist destination in the western state of Guerrero. It's known for its silver mines and fine jewelry. Taxco's narrow cobblestone streets wind amidst jewelry shops, restaurants, and small hotels. But in June, a gun battle between the Mexican army and alleged drug cartel members in Taxco left 15 people dead. The shooting, against a backdrop of picturesque colonial architecture, went on for almost 40 minutes in the middle of the day and was captured by a local TV cameraman. A few weeks earlier, authorities had pulled 55 bodies out of one of Taxco's abandoned silver mines. A local drug gang had been dumping their rivals, sometimes alive, down the 500-foot ventilation shaft. Early on in this drug war, President Calderón said that most of the dead were cartel members. The implication was that the violence is only eliminating the bad people. But as the war has spread, so have the casualties. In May, a former presidential candidate from Calderón's own party, Diego Fernández de Ceballos, was kidnapped and is still missing. In June, the leading gubernatorial candidate in the northern state of Tamaulipas was assassinated just days before the election. Ciudad Victoria, the capital of Tamaulipas, is a small city of about 300,000 people. Its markets overflow with vegetables. Vendors sell mango and melon drinks from thick glass vats perched on pushcarts. Music blares from a CD stand. Old men in straw cowboy hats sit in the shade on the city square. At first glance, Ciudad Victoria looks peaceful. But the local Catholic bishop, Antonio González Sánchez, says people here are terrified.
Pues ya la violencia ya ha invadido a casi todo el estado. Casi no tenemos municipios donde no haya violencia.
Now the violence has invaded nearly all of the state, the bishop says. We don't have hardly anywhere where there isn't violence, where there aren't killings, kidnappings. Unfortunately, it's nearly everywhere. Bishop Gonzalez says the assassination of Rodolfo Torre Cantú, the leading candidate for governor, sent a powerful message that no one in Tamaulipas is safe.
La gente piensa, y creo que con razón,
the people feel, and I think with good reason, González says, that when the government says that they're going to overcome the violence, it's a lie, no? And the violence stretches from the Gulf to the Pacific, and from the Guatemalan border up to Tijuana. In Nayarit, just north of Puerto Vallarta, the governor shut the public schools 3 weeks before the summer break after a series of bloody midday firefights. In the industrial city of Monterrey, school children are being trained in how to hit the ground if there's a shootout. Along the U.S. border, local news reports indicate that hundreds of thousands of people have fled violence-plagued cities all along the frontier. In Ciudad Juarez last month, workers at a blanket shop picked through the remnants of their shattered plate glass windows after a car bomb exploded up the street. The Juarez cartel claimed responsibility for the blast that killed 3 people. In a conflict in which bodies regularly get strung up from highway overpasses and severed human heads are used to send less than subtle warnings, the July 15th car bomb represented an escalation of the violence. Politicians and the press debated narco-terrorism and the Colombianization of Mexico. After the car bombing, the mayor of Juarez, José Reyes Ferriz, said, "We have to be on alert." He ordered all the municipal police to take their flak jackets and weapons home with them at the end of their shifts. Juarez, just across the border from El Paso, has been particularly hard hit by the drug war. The fighting intensified in 2008 as the Sinaloan cartel invaded the Juarez cartel's turf. Since then, more than 6,000 people have been killed in this city alone. Extortion and kidnappings have flourished. In early 2009, the Mexican military took control of security in Juarez. Thousands of soldiers patrolled the streets. When that didn't work, the federal police took over. But the violence just continues to get worse. At the Juarez prison, inmates are housed in separate wings according to their gang affiliation. The Aztecas live in open cell blocks that are immaculately clean and look nicer than some of Mexico's housing projects. The Aztecas are clearly wealthier than any of the other gangs in the institution. The Aztecas are aligned with the Juarez cartel and have been fighting to drive the Sinaloans out of the city. Francisco Garcia, a gunrunner for the Aztecas, says the violence isn't going to stop.
There's a war going on. Nobody could go in and say, hey, that's it. We can't do that because they already killed so many people with us in them.
Garcia is a U.S. citizen. He was born in El Paso, but he says the Aztecas and Juarez are his people. His hair is shaved close to his scalp, and a green tattooed tear drips from the corner of his left eye.
I came over here and I got caught in the bridge with two guns.
The 24-year-old says that that was his job on the outside, shuttling weapons from Texas into Mexico.
Any kind of guns, any kinds of weapons that we could use, I was bringing them from over there.
Garcia says the Aztecas had a well-organized system in the U.S. Other people obtained the guns and brought them to him in El Paso. His task was to move them across the border and deliver them to a contact in Juarez. The Aztecas have a well-organized system inside the prison, too. In their portion of the compound, they have vegetable gardens, an automotive workshop, art studios. There's even an ice cream shop and their own pizza place they call Domino's. While the Juarez prison feels calm during this visit, prison riots in Mexico between rival gangs have killed scores of inmates over the last 2 years. Garcia says as soon as he finishes his 4-year prison term, he plans to go right back to working for the Aztecas on the outside.
This is my life. This is what I chose to be in. I can't just walk out.
Garcia grew up poor in El Paso. As a kid, he says his family lacked a lot of things. The Aztecas, on the other hand, offered him fast money. He says he expects to either die young with the Aztecas or spend most of his life in prison, and he says he's okay with that. In Mexico, more than 4 million people live in what the government terms extreme poverty. For the cartels, this huge pool of the poor serves as a recruiting ground for foot soldiers in a war that's growing more deadly every month. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
It's been more than 70 years since Spain's brutal civil war brought the dictator Francisco Franco to power. During his rule, tens of thousands of people went missing or were executed for opposing him. Now relatives of the dead and disappeared are demanding justice. But an amnesty law protects the executioners, and the Spanish judge who challenged that law and tried to open an inquiry into the Franco-era atrocities has now been suspended. NPR's Silvio Pajoli reports from Spain.
Me llamo Virgilio Lerer Ruiz. Soy aviador.
Film director Pedro Almodóvar gives voice to Virgilio Lerer Ruiz, a pilot who opposed the military coup in 1936. I was the first person executed in the Civil War, he says. I had no trial, no lawyer, and no sentence. My daughters continue to look for me. For how long? This video was made by 15 famous Spaniards who recite the testimony of 15 ordinary men and women killed during and after the Civil War. Shop owners, teachers, farmers, people on the losing side of the war whose remains are believed buried in mass graves. The video was made to protest the Supreme Court ruling charging investigating magistrate Baltasar Garzón with abuse of power for the first in-depth probe into the Franco regime. Garzón is accused of violating a 1977 amnesty law known as the Pact of Forgetting, passed 2 years after Franco died. Garzón is a champion of universal jurisdiction, the concept that crimes against humanity cannot be amnestied or subject to statutes of limitations. Recently, he spoke at the 16th anniversary of the Jewish Community Center bombing in Buenos Aires that killed 85 people. More than anyone else, he said, investigating judges cannot shirk their responsibilities.
Más poder, más responsabilidad y mayor exigencia de justicia debe haber.
The one who had the resources in his hands and didn't use them, the one who could have demanded and didn't, should not be able to escape, regardless of time, his legal and civil responsibilities. Never again.
Nunca más. Lehaim por la vida.
Garzón shot to fame for having Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet arrested while he was visiting London in 1998. He has pursued Al-Qaeda and Basque terrorists, corrupt politicians and gangsters, as well as members of the Argentine military junta that executed tens of thousands of opponents. Garzón's trouble started when the small far-right group Manos Limpias, Clean Hands, filed a complaint against him. Miguel Bernard is the group's secretary general.
Garzón viola todas las leyes, la Constitución española, la ley de amnistía.
Garzón violates all Spanish laws. He cannot prosecute Francoism. It's already history, and only historians can judge that period. He uses justice for his own ego. He thought that by prosecuting Francoism, he could become the head of the International Criminal Court and even win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Verdad, justicia, reparación.
Since Garzón's suspension, several hundred relatives of the victims gather once a week across the building in Madrid, used by Franco's secret police to detain and torture opponents. They carry photos of some of the 113,000 missing Spaniards, including poet Federico García Lorca. But their vocal demand for truth and justice shows that Spanish society is still sharply divided. A small group of bystanders provokes the marchers. You killed Padre, my father, shouts one. You killed Padre, the priest in my town, shouts another. The marchers call the bystanders fascists and terrorists. Adolfo Llanos Urgiola is furious with the marchers.
Everything was a reconciliation after the democracy. They don't want reconciliation. They want open the graves. They want everything we don't want.
But Juan Diego Boto, a young actor, just wants the Spanish government to open up all the mass graves and identify the bodies.
It's difficult to build a democracy over impunity. It's difficult to build any system of justice over dead bodies buried all over your country.
Puri Galano marches with a photo of her grandparents who disappeared in 1940, 1 year after the end of the Civil War. She says the move against Garzón has energized the movement to account for the tens of thousands killed by the Franco regime.
All we wanted before Garzón got put out was to recuperate our families and to clean their names. He helped us. He helped us to uncover the whole thing.
But if convicted, Judge Garzón could face suspension for 20 years, virtually ending his career. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News.
Coming up, unifying the call to prayer in Cairo.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. In the Egyptian capital, Cairo, a Muslim tradition nearly as old as Islam itself is about to end. No longer will hundreds of voices boom from minarets across the sprawling Egyptian city to call the faithful to prayer. Instead, the government plans to broadcast a single call to prayer from a downtown studio. Mosques in Cairo will be required to use that new call, bringing uniformity to a ritual that some felt was getting out of control. But as NPR's Soraya Sahadi Nelson reports, many residents of Cairo are uneasy about the plan.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
5 times a day over the past 9 years, Ihab Muhammad has delivered the melodic ezan, or call to prayer, from his neighborhood mosque in Cairo. So have thousands of other prayer callers, and not always in unison, like on this windy day. Critics say the result is hardly music to the ears. It's chaos, chaos, says Abdul Munam Soroji during a visit to a hilltop park in the capital. The Syrian tourist says Cairo should do what his hometown of Damascus does, issue a uniform call to prayer. He and others tired of the uncoordinated Egyptian version will soon get their wish. Officials at the Ministry of Religious Endowment say after years of wrangling over the issue, they've selected a handful of callers to take turns delivering the ezan starting next week. This new azan will soon be the only one allowed here, a single voice broadcast from a downtown studio that is transmitted through special receivers to thousands of mosques registered with the government. Officials who declined to speak on tape say the change is necessary to restore the dignity of the azan. They add the callers or muezzin being banned get to keep their salaries. They will be assigned other tasks in their mosques, such as leading prayers or cleaning. Many religious scholars, including Muhammad el-Shahat el-Gindi at Helwan University, support the decision.
This kind of confusion, this kind of crowded voices, I think that is against the spirit of azan.
El-Gindi adds the verses sung may also differ from mosque to mosque, thereby confusing the worshipper. But Muezzin Ehab Muhammad is not happy about being silenced, even if he does get to keep his salary of $55 a month. His friend Muhammad Fauzi, who delivers the azan at a mosque down the street, says to them it's not just a job. He believes being a muezzin gives them a leg up in the next life.
The prophet says those who lead the prayer have the longest necks and will stand the tallest on Judgment Day. So, of course, I'm against them denying us the azan.
Back at the hilltop, Al-Azhar Park, some residents like Aya Hassan also expressed displeasure over the ministry's plan.
All the different voices make you feel like everyone is kneeling and praying to Allah at the same time. One voice will seem empty.
The 20-year-old pharmacy student worries that residents in the city's many squatter neighborhoods could end up unaware of when to pray if their unofficial mosques are not given transmitters. Others say the call to prayer is a religious matter and that the government shouldn't be involved in changing it. But for the religion ministry, the matter is no longer open to discussion. It says the new azan will be introduced district by district in Cairo when the holy fasting month of Ramadan begins next week. Officials don't plan to stop there. They say eventually more than 100,000 mosques across Egypt will deliver a uniform call to prayer. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.